Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your ravishingly beautiful corpse flower of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You're listening to Miles Davis. The song is called Come Get It. It's a sad, sad day. There is no joy in Popcastville today. It's Ben Ratliff's farewell. Hey, Ben.
Hey. Thank you for calling me a corpse flower.
You're beautiful, but you're disappearing.
It's a rare occurrence, right? That it blooms?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. As I think of you, a rarely blooming yet overwhelmingly powerful and fragrant flower.
Wait, okay. I am rarely blooming.
Yes.
And I am overwhelmingly
fragrant.
Fragrant.
And lovely.
In kind of a horrible way.
I actually haven't smelled the corpse. I haven't smelled the corpse flower, okay. To be fair. I got to get out to the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. I got to holler at that this weekend. I'll let you know. It'll probably be too late to make any edits to this, but I'll let you know.
That was also the name of my first band.
Corpse Flower?
Yeah.
If that was the case, that'd be fire.
It's not the case.
We should make fake hardcore t-shirts for a band called Corpse Flower.
Yeah.
Actually, we probably just put fake songs on Bandcamp. We'd get written by the New York Times, probably. All right, so we're here. We're joking, but obviously, you know, this is a sad day for me. For our listeners who do not know, Ben Ratliff is leaving the New York Times. He has taken a buyout, so he's going to roll around in his cash in his bed and have a wonderful, wonderful time, and move on to write books and teach and do all kinds of magnificent things outside the building. But I was not going to let him leave without one final interrogation. So here we are. Thank you, Ben, for submitting to that.
Thank you. Don't know what I'm getting into.
You don't, actually. So we're going to do a little bit of Paris Review stuff, a little bit of maybe a little Proust questionnaire stuff, maybe a little roast. You never really know.
Okay.
Let's start with the song we came in on before we began taping. I asked you if you could identify for me a moment when you were young where you engaged with music or were engaged by music in such a way that you recognized as a kind of protean form of criticism, or what you later came to understand was a critical ear.
Yeah.
And that's what you brought up. Tell me about that show that you were at. It was a live show that you saw Miles at.
Yeah.
How old and when and where?
Probably was maybe 83, 84, which means that I would have been at 14, 15, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was aware of Miles Davis's work in the 1950s, his group with John Coltrane.
And you were aware of that listening in the house?
We had a friend of the family who knew I was interested in records and would sometimes strategically feed me a record.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it might take me 6 months, but I would get all around it. You know?
Did you see it as like dutiful homework, or were you genuinely curious?
No, I was curious.
Yeah.
I was curious. So I knew about Miles Davis to some degree, but then he came back. You know, Miles Davis was inactive through the 70s, and then the early 80s he returned, and he started playing gigs again, and he started making records again. And I went to a Miles concert in New Jersey at that age. And so there he was, this strange-looking man with big sunglasses.
Yeah, crazy glasses, I bet.
Looking a little frail, but playing some loud and dense and funky, weirdly messy music, turning his back on the audience a lot. And it was more than just like, oh, I'm going to do my cool thing of turning my back. He was turning his back on his audience for long periods of time.
The hell with y'all.
He was playing the trumpet just in little bits, little phrases, and then he would play dissonant clusters on a keyboard. It was so confusing, but confusing in a great way.
Who'd you go to that show with?
My parents, I'm pretty sure.
And do you remember looking at them and being like, what's going on here? Or like, did they have any better grip on it than you did?
I think they felt that Miles Davis is a personage. Let's go to this thing and see what he's up to.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I don't think they necessarily had a key to what was going on.
That's how I feel about Radiohead, except I just don't go.
we should devote the second half of this to Radiohead.
Yeah. Just 20 minutes of silence, basically?
Our mutual incomprehension. And so I do remember thinking, man, I want to know what's going on here. Mm-hmm. I want to know what's going on here. First of all, this person bears no resemblance to the younger Miles Davis, mm-hmm. visually or sonically. That was fascinating, mm. you know? It's not like an old rock star situation where, you know, you basically understand it's the same person. I did feel that I wanted to write about it. I had that sense. And by that time, I was already reading things in the Village Voice and mm-hmm. I think Rolling Stone, and I was aware that there was a tradition of music criticism. And
who was writing about jazz for The Voice at that point?
Who was writing about jazz for
this
The Voice?
Giddens,
it was Gary Giddens. It was Gary Giddens and Stanley Crouch, mm-hmm. Maybe still by that point, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How deep into the jazz criticism tradition were you at that time? Like, were you?
Oh, not.
So you weren't like, I'm going to read the race debates of jazz times in the 60s or whatever. Like, it was not.
No. I didn't know all that stuff at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I learned first was the music for jazz. I mean, I really sort of late high school and college, I got completely into it. And I went to a college that had a great radio station. Mm-hmm. And
what's the radio station?
It was WKCR at Columbia.
Hey, now.
And as I've said a bunch of times before, that was really my first experience of something like the internet,
right?
There it is, all the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And you start from what you know, the little tiny bits you know, mm-hmm. and you start working backward to figure out how history led to what you know.
So did you get a show on the radio, say? Like, is
yeah.
that how it worked?
Yeah.
So this is in what year? This is
85, 86? Yeah.
Are a lot of kids really clamoring to do jazz on WKCR at this point, or are you sort of a one of three? Kind
well,
of?
Jazz was the thing on that station. Mm-hmm. At that point, the station was maybe, I don't know, 60% jazz, mm-hmm. and it was really good. Mm-hmm. And there were elder figures there who could sort of guide you. You know, you were in New York, and you could interview whoever you wanted, and it was a great opportunity for somebody who wanted to learn a lot. But I didn't really do a whole lot of jazz, actually.
On the radio station?
No, not until the very end.
What'd you do? Krautrock?
No, they didn't have that. They didn't have anything rocky. They didn't really have anything rocky.
Any classical?
I did new music, like overnight yeah. shows.
So basically just like a tone.
I did, yeah, sure.
You just played a tone yeah. for 2 hours.
country music.
They had country music?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Quite a lot.
Really?
At that point.
I think on my college radio station, WHRB,
yeah.
I think the last country had been excised like by the 80s.
Yeah.
Like we were left with only classical jazz and like absurdist noise rock
right.
with like one night of hip hop, which is how I got my foothold.
Yeah.
Country, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
It was sort of like pre-alt
yeah,
country,
sure.
you know?
Yeah.
It was like Dwight Yoakam's first EP and the Last Roundup, a New York group called The Last Roundup. And I don't know, there was a whole sort of downtown New York slash
like hipster traditionalists
slash, yeah. mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
That kind of scene. There were some interesting things going on. We were playing old country music.
Mm-hmm. Is Carter we Family doing. Old.
Yes. We were yeah. playing everything from the beginnings to mid-period Waylon Jennings.
Right. Mm-hmm. At that point, were you also writing or were you in the school paper? Were you doing anything like that?
I was writing just a little bit. Mm-hmm. I was writing just a little bit in the school paper.
Did you understand yourself as a writer or were you sort of like, I'm going to be a physicist who really loves jazz?
Yes. I understood that I wanted to be a writer, 100%. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to be writing. I have a terrible mind for plot. So narrative fiction has never really worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading more and more cultural criticism and getting more and more interested in it. And I eventually took a class with Gary Giddens at Columbia. And that was encouraging. And I realized that criticism is infinitely flexible. Mm-hmm. Both in terms of form. I mean, it isn't a form. It's just a way of looking. But also in terms of with the pretext of criticism, with the final result being I'm going to write about this new record or whatever it is, you can come at it from any direction
anything.
You want.
Mm-hmm.
You can, through any kind of historical or social or aesthetic filter.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that and you knew that right from the jump?
I knew that from reading people like mid-century critics, mm-hmm. you know, American almost entirely.
Like music critics or other disciplines?
No, other mostly.
So like Hilton Kramer type people or?
I was reading James Agee and Pauline Kael and Dwight McDonald. And
who's Dwight McDonald?
Oh, he wrote about the arts.
What a life. What a life.
He wrote a lot about film, and he wrote a lot about books, and he wrote a lot about politics.
And about Young Thug.
Yeah.
Very well known.
And also James Baldwin's essays I read, extremely powerful for me when I was a young teenager. And then eventually Ralph Ellison's essays. And I just kind of figured out there's something to say about music.
In your earlier writing, did you approach music with more of that more of a historical import lens? Because I feel like one of the things I most enjoy about your writing is you have an ability to zero in on the sound and zero in on texture, which are these sort of weirdly ahistorical things. I wonder if you started like that or if that was sort of a refinement process that came out of, you know, years of workshopping yourself.
You're right. I mean, I did adopt it as an article of faith.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that what is graspable in one particular present moment carries tons of information. And if you can describe that moment in a piece of music, it's best to pick an interesting moment, a moment where a lot of stuff is happening, or a particularly representative moment of a performance or a piece of music. Then, you know, you seize on that and you almost turn it into a physical thing, and as if you're looking at it, and then you describe it as well as you can, and you just assume that the truth of the thing is going to come up through the writing. Mm. I think it has to do that I'm terrible with plot. I'm terrible with story. I'm okay with history, with a lot of learning and research and putting in the time. I just felt that what I was best at and what I liked most was the challenge of describing sound and trying to figure out what was most important that was coming through it.
Do you like insulting music ever when you were younger? Did you get off on it?
Oh, you mean saying this stinks?
Trash something.
Just with my friends?
No, I mean in print.
Oh, in print.
Yeah.
I never really had a lot of fun with that, to be honest, because I was never really a wise guy, and I was never really a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
So my time was much better spent just like putting my head in there, really as if it were a physical space. The more that I can turn music into something physical, the better it is, the happier I am.
To turn music into architecture.
Yeah, something, maybe a sculpture, maybe a painting, maybe just a shape.
Yeah, I mean, you really are maybe one of the only critics I care about who cares about sound art.
Uh-huh.
I think sound art is like largely absurd and reprehensible, and like obviously it's like ridiculous. It'd be like portraiture is terrible. You know, it's like obviously it's not that broad a stroke.
Yeah.
But I find sound art to be like by and large deeply unengaged. Like, you know, apart from like if I want sound art, like my version of sound art is I went to go see Godspeed You Black Emperor at the old Knitting Factory and had to leave because I was about to throw up.
Yeah.
That was sound art. Mm-hmm. Like I went to see Sigur Rós when they played the Beacon Theater and I was bawling, and I had to, like, I couldn't be in the room because, like, whatever frequency they were vibrating was, like, not a good one for me.
Yeah.
But short of that, like, I don't need to see some guy just, like, walking, you know, go in a room and hear, like, boom, boom.
Well, sometimes it's terrible for sure, but if there's something interesting going on in terms of what the listener expects and the mental process that the listener is going through in relation to the music, I think you can write some pretty interesting things about that. You can write interesting things about going for a walk.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is it's a thing I admired you because also you have the patience to really even think that you could write something good about sound art. So Godspeed to you in that particular thing.
You know who was great on that of music? Tom Johnson, who used to write for the Village Voice in the 70s.
I've never read Tom Johnson.
There's a collection of his writing called The Voice of New Music. It must be out of print now, but I think it's available online. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you can see the entire book online. He wrote beautifully and with a real easy-going touch about going to these performances in downtown lofts or whatever, Lamont Young and Charlemagne Palestine and so on and so forth. He wrote about it kind of as a like he knew a lot and he was himself a composer, but he kind of wrote about it as an outsider. Mm-hmm. I've always liked that approach. I don't want to write from the point of view of the guy who knows more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because that is, in essence, not that all critics have to know more than their audiences, but there is a presumption of authority.
Mm.
And I see you smirking a little bit because I know this is something we maybe disagree on a mm-hmm. little bit, mm-hmm. where our approaches are in different directions.
Yeah.
Because that's something that I value about criticism, both in terms of how I can do it,
yeah.
but also criticism I really like to read and yeah. criticism that I'm personally engaged
You want
by.
To read the guy who knows the most.
I want to read the guy who knows a thing I don't know.
Sure.
Because
well,
most
value. You want to find some value.
Yeah, and like most means a different, like I feel very differently about this at my age than I did when I was 20, for yeah. example. Like yeah. in 20, I think I only thought about it in linear terms.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to start at this level and eventually I'll get to this higher level. And that's fundamentally better than the level I'm at right now. Mm. Whereas now I can read criticism written by all types of people coming from all different angles. Some maybe you know more than I do. Some maybe know less than I do. But I can derive meaning and value from mm-hmm. all the different approaches. Mm. For me, that took a long time to get mm-hmm. to. Whereas for you, that was your native approach.
Yeah.
Why? What are you scared of?
Oh, I don't think it has to do with that at all. I mean, I guess I'm grateful when I read something that teaches me something I didn't know, for sure. That's, of course, an obvious value. But if I can read something that gives me a certain way of hearing something that presents to me a certain kind of temperament. I mean, then I'm just being given the chance to experience the music through somebody else, think about it slightly differently. Music is really mysterious mm-hmm. to me.
And remains, so
yeah,
I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, really mysterious. And that's what's so good about it.
Well, but do you think that's also in part a reflection of I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg, but of what you're attracted to. Because I would venture to say the less mysterious stuff is not the stuff that gets you up in the morning.
Mm. More and more that's true, I think.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I do like pop music.
I'm not out to paint you as some blowhard who thinks pop is terrible, but in your farewell memo,
yeah,
you know, I referred to this Enrique Iglesias concert that reviewed, which was the concert was actually both Enrique and J-Lo. But what I found funny in rereading, because it always sort of stuck in my mind, and then when I revisited it, what I found really funny about it was I felt like you found a way to imbue this like deeply non-mysterious thing with a mystery. Like that was what you took away, or what you brought something to it that maybe it couldn't have achieved on its own.
Well, what you're seeing in an Enrique Iglesias concert, you are seeing commerce enacted, but you're also seeing some kind of ritual. You know, you're seeing this guy is doing something because he needs to do it on some level, and that there's some mystery in that. The audience is there seeking things from him that they need from him. He's satisfying some desire. Like, the question I often ask myself is, what is this music for? Like, what is it doing? What function is it serving? That opens up lots of interesting questions. And the answer tends to go beyond technical ability or the will to do something better, faster, louder, to sell more records, whatever. Around music, there's so much desire, ambition.
Mm-hmm. Historical debates.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Complicated, mysterious things.
Yeah. Let's listen to some Enrique.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Okay, I'll give you the choice. Since it's your last day, I'll give you a choice. Bailamos or Bailando?
Bailamo.
Bailamo. Okay. Don't let the world in outside. Don't let a moment go by. Nothing can stop us tonight. Now that the rhythm has taken us over, we're back. I want to talk about interviewing people because I feel like you do that sometimes.
Yeah.
We all do here. It's part of, it's sort of an implicit part of the job. this is something that I know I've struggled with.
Mm.
A lot of times there'll be a record I really like, and then someone will say, you know, an editor or a colleague will say, oh, you should talk to that person. And my reaction is, I don't have anything to ask that person.
Right.
I wonder if you can think of some examples where you've learned something by interviewing an artist that you maybe could not have arrived at on your own. And now I don't mean to be so presumptuous as saying that I can't spend an hour with Joe Blow or Jane Blow and figure out something that I didn't hear on the record. But I mean, truly, on a substantive level, really understand something about music or that person's compositions that would have been totally obscure to you without the conversation.
I sometimes find that the real winner of the situation is me, because because I got to, you know, the reader might not learn anything new from what I have to deliver them.
Yeah, I'm talking about you. I'm not worried, but no shots to our readers and our loyal listeners, but I'm talking about you.
In the kinds of interviews that I like to do best, which involve spending kind of a long time with people in one session, I try to figure out who this person is. Something about their personality, something about how they think, what they want to do, and how they hear. The more resistant they are, the better. Sometimes it takes 2 hours to just break through, and then everything starts to move, you know? I guess that the best experiences I had interviewing with, you know, people were probably in that series that I did
the playing
some years
records
back.
For.
Yeah, where I got together with jazz musicians and sat down with them and allowed them to pick music that they felt close to, and then we would listen to it. Sometimes we'd listen to it two or three times, and they'd point out things that they heard. Almost always they were things that I didn't hear.
Sure.
And this became a way of going through their own histories, but also talking about what they reacted to in terms of sound and how music works.
Do you think musicians are natural critics?
Some of them, yeah.
But not all?
No.
Yeah.
Some musicians just basically are critics. Like, that's what they are first and foremost. They're musicians sort of second.
That's interesting. Give me an example of someone who sticks out in your mind like that.
Ryan Adams? I don't know. No, I don't know. I can think of
even if that's the wrong. It's a great answer.
It's insulting. It's insulting.
Shouts to Ryan Adams, who has me blocked on Twitter.
It's insulting to say that about any musician. So
I actually disagree with that. I think that's probably the nicest thing that you could possibly say about Ryan Adams, just for what it's worth.
I mean, I think that criticism is a very basic human function, don't you? And by the way, can we just like go to like the class number one, where everything starts in the discussion about criticism? Criticism, the word criticism, the idea, it doesn't mean putting people down.
No, only when it's warranted.
Yes, but lots of people think that it does.
They still think that. I understand that.
They equate
criticism with hating.
Yeah, and I have a problem with the idea of hating, by the way.
As do I.
Do you?
I have a problem with the idea of it, not the practice. Like I said, sometimes it's warranted.
Yeah, hating.
And that is where the critical part of criticism comes in.
Yeah.
That I don't mind getting into. I don't mind messing around in those waters.
Back to the thing about, are lots of musicians also critics, or do they have that function within them? I think that a lot of musicians don't really understand criticism or just don't want to think about it that much, because it's sort of, to them, it possibly, perhaps from experience, represents a kind of negative energy pushing back against this very fragile and complicated thing that they're trying to build.
An urge that they have.
Yeah.
And how can you actually critique an urge? And what I often, anytime I sort of have, this doesn't happen a lot, but, you know, I've had the occasional confrontational conversation with someone who I've negatively critiqued.
Sure.
And I try to explain to them, like, I'm not critiquing their emotional impulse or their feelings.
Yeah.
I'm critiquing a piece of work.
Yeah.
And that plenty of noble pieces of work have come from terrible places, and plenty of terrible pieces of work have come from noble places. And if I was there to critique their feelings, I'd be a therapist and I'd be getting paid way better.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to make those distinctions.
You know, it's funny. There's being a critic, and then there's being a critic at the New York Times.
Yeah. How much more of a burden is it to be the critic here?
Well, to get away from the question of the burden for a minute, one thing you come to learn very quickly when you start to write for this paper is you take upon yourself all the ethical rules and also the in-house language limitations, mm-hmm. and you change accordingly. And that can be rough.
Yeah. Did you find it a tough adjustment? You've been here, this is 20 years now, right?
Yeah.
How long do you feel like it took before you got a rhythm that worked for you and worked for the paper?
I got it really quickly, mm-hmm. because I had been writing for the Village Voice a little bit before that, but I wasn't getting deep into vernacular cussing.
Oh, see, like my stuff for the Voice before when I was free, it was like real spazzy.
Was it?
And real like... Just like I read it now and I'm like, I don't even understand what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
Like there was like some Kid 606 review I wrote and I reread it and I was like, what the hell? Like literally I have no idea what this is
about. Were
you
writing it for like your friend?
No, I think I was writing it in some kind of like Kriskow density, Chuck Eddy references,
sure. yeah.
post-grad school
yeah, sure.
kind of like ideas, yeah. but zap, 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 zap.
Yeah.
And like... coming out of hip hop with like a natural kind of like chip on my shoulder.
Yeah.
And somehow all of those things like woven together.
Yeah.
Just made for some ridiculously inscrutable sentences.
And that kind of stuff doesn't fly.
Can't
at
do
the
it.
Times, right?
Can't
I mean,
do
the
it.
Trouble I had at the Times at first was writing about abstract music, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I would get too much in my head.
Yeah.
I was writing in terms that only I could understand. Also, I was getting maybe a little too inside baseball. There was a great copy editor here nicknamed Kaz. Everybody called him Kaz.
Grandmaster Kaz?
No, Don Caswell.
Oh, that's too bad.
And he was one of the greatest writing teachers I ever had. And I remember I had written a review of this guitar player, Joe Morris, probably at the Knitting Factory. You know, his reaction was, I don't get, what are you doing? What are you saying? You know, I've had that reaction from editors on other occasions, and felt sort of like, well, you know what I'm saying.
Right.
Let's not do this. Let's not do this exercise. But from him, I don't know. Somehow that day I was ready to learn.
Yeah,
and he was able to help me comb it out and make me understand that it was important to talk to the reader. By putting your hands on the reader's shoulders and looking in the reader's eyes,
mm-hmm.
and guiding you through a piece of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And criticism is any kind of writing, but is like a performance.
Yeah, of course.
Criticism included. Well, you are helping guide the reader through your performance. You're going to use paragraph breaks as well as you possibly can. You're going to highlight certain ideas by putting them in the like prime real estate positions of the piece. Anyway, I miss that guy. And I've also learned a lot from other Times copy editors.
Mm-hmm.
They just taught me how to express myself straight,
mm-hmm.
and taught me to defend things that I wanted to say.
Shouts to defending things against
yeah.
the copy desk.
Yeah.
Sort of an underappreciated function of the copy editing process.
Yeah, sure.
Is being on the receiving end of, I don't get this, this doesn't work, it's not necessary. And you knowing, actually, no, like maybe that other thing wasn't necessary, but this,
yeah.
this is important.
Sure.
And this I'll fight for.
Yep.
Yeah.
But also coming here, there were standards set by writers that I really respected as critics. And these were not, as you were saying, at the Voice, it was something different. There was a much more like voice, bang, mm-hmm. bang it around.
It's free jazz,
know,
dog.
Free jazz kind of thing. Incredible things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Tate,
yeah, you
absolutely
read Greg
fantastic.
Yeah, of course. You read
Kriskow with his wild density.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's art.
Yeah.
Margot Jefferson writing about books, whew, just
yeah.
smoking for
yeah.
the short period of time that she did that.
Yeah.
I remember Jennifer Dunning writing about dance. Like there was a certain generosity of spirit in those columns. Going back, Robert Palmer,
mm-hmm.
predecessor a couple of places before me. Those were really important things that he wrote, bringing a whole lot of different kinds of music together. Just like there's some good writers here, you know, real grown-ups.
Mm-hmm. You were how old? So you were in your...
I was 27.
27 when you came
I
here.
Got here, mm-hmm. and felt very young.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad I didn't get here until later than that. I think I would have had less of a backbone. I think it would have. I think I would have folded more than I did.
Well, I'll tell you, not too long after I got here, I wrote something. We were visited by a sort of high-ranking performing arts executive, and we did a big lunchtime meeting in a conference room in the old building around a big table. So it was me and the arts executive and all of my editors, all of my superiors. And this guy questioned the idea of hiring a 27-year-old to write about something as important as jazz. I think I'd made a mistake in some piece that, you know, that he had, some piece about a performance that he had a hand in. Mm-hmm. It was very embarrassing. He called me out in front of everybody around that table, everybody I was working for. I did feel young, and I did feel scolded, embarrassed. And that experience made me want to do better, but it also made me want to know more, and specifically made me want to know more than him.
Yeah.
And I realized that from that point on, really, people who seemed as if they were telling me that their music was the most important music, the most important music, I didn't want to listen. I just wanted to know more. I mean, my main idea became, I want to be able to show that lots of different kinds of music have something to do with each other and are all sort of, it's okay that they're all on the same level and can be treated on the same
right.
level.
Right. In essence, you wanted to set your own, not hierarchies, but you wanted to set your own roadmaps.
Yes.
Instead of receiving what Joe Executive
yes.
wanted to come and tell you about
right.
whatever was going on at
right.
Jazz Incorporated.
Well, wherever it was, yeah.
Jazz Incorporated. That'd be a fly show for like kids, like mm-hmm. like Kids Incorporated, but mm-hmm. about jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, better be super hot on like mm-hmm. the Disney Channel or something. Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to work on that. So where's that guy now? You want to shout him out?
Not sure.
Okay.
Honestly.
Okay, well, if you're listening, sir, good day. Good day to you.
No disrespect to him.
I have disrespect to him. You don't have to, but yeah, I'll take it on for you. I have no problem. And if I ever bump into him on the street, and he's like, I'm that guy. You don't want it with me, sir.
Those confrontations teach you good things.
Right, but they didn't teach him any good things.
So, well, we don't know.
Yeah.
I never followed up with him.
A thing that I noticed when I came here in the first few years that I was here, maybe even up until last year, is that you always wanted to review Jingle Ball.
Oh, yeah.
And I've always assumed that was because of your children.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate? If not because of, it's somehow related to your role as a parent.
It was exciting to bring my children to an event where they knew something about most of the performers.
Right.
We were talking earlier about music as a ritual. I just found it an incredibly great ritual and so easy to write about.
Yeah, very easy to write about. Yes.
So easy, you know, because it's so supercharged. It's so mediated. It's so scripted. It's a great thing to write about in the New York Times.
What are some things that parenting more broadly or your kids specifically have brought to your ear about music?
They're not going to have the same taste as me.
Yeah.
That's number one.
Well, that's for sure.
They're interested in different things because they're different people.
Do you ever sort of be like, how'd you land on that? Like, does that...
Sure.
Like, what's an example of a thing that you're just like...
Oh, man. I'm not going to talk about my kids like that.
Not just even like one musician
no,
where you're
no,
like...
won't do it.
Okay.
Nope, won't do it.
So
I'm sorry.
The answer's fish. Just. I know he doesn't want to talk about it. The answer's fish.
No. Music is... partly social, you know, music, interest in music is partly social and partly just comes from you, from some mysterious place in you. And it has something to do with what you need, what this music does for you, and also who you trust.
Mm-hmm.
When you're young and you're a listener, there's so much identification with the performer
mm-hmm.
or with the song. Some kids just need to trust. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They need to, and then when
that's like a core thing.
Core thing.
Yeah.
Then when you get older, you sort of throw trust out the window,
mm-hmm.
or you realize that the, you know, you start to like the unreliable narrator. You start mm-hmm. to understand that singer-songwriters aren't actually writing about themselves for the most part, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're young, you want that.
Well, you want, it's an identification thing. It's a, like you say, it's a trust thing. It's the development of a belief system.
Yeah.
And like, you know, maybe it's, for some kids it's music, maybe for some kids it's TV or video games or, you know, whatever. I mean, everybody has a different thing, but it's core fiber stuff.
Yeah.
It certainly was for me. You know, and I think for anyone who I always find it very hard to relate to people in any context who don't have that kind of relationship to something. I've always found that a challenge. I find it strange because I don't know how to, I don't know how I would have navigated my childhood or my teenage years without that kind of depth of feeling and commitment to understanding the world through art.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I meet people who
just seem adrift,
they
don't have that thing.
Yeah, I find it odd. Mm-hmm. I always find it odd. And obviously it's like no shots to anyone in particular. It's just, it's not a vibration that, mm-hmm. that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have children, but I'd be like, if my kids don't feel that way about art of some kind, I'd be like really weird. Mm-hmm. It'd be very, very surprising.
Well, also you can't push them.
No, I mean, they may end up as fish fans and you just got to go with it.
Yeah. And you know, and fine if they do.
just weep on the sides. Wait till they go off to college and then just cry for 3 months.
I will tell you that I had an experience a year or two ago of passing the bedroom door of one of my kids. And he was listening to a song from the John Coltrane record, Giant Steps.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to you, I did not like push this thing on him. He found his way to it for some reason. Maybe it had something to do with a school assignment. I don't know. But he was listening to this record a lot. And so I passed the door and I was like, is that what I think it is? And I stood there and the door was closed. I stood there for a little bit. And I swear to you, I was hearing new things in the music.
Wow.
Music that I knew really well.
I mean, yeah, of course.
And I felt that I was hearing new things in it in that context.
Wow.
So as a parent, that's the best thing that can come from your kids' experience of music is that those weird moments when you're kind of hearing it through their ears a little bit.
You emailed me earlier today with that quote from the rockcritics.com interview where you were talking about something similar to something I said on Bobcast last week, which is basically like we can't assess. You don't want to be like a victim or a captive of your teenage taste.
You can't judge the music of your day with the taste of a prior day.
Yeah.
That's what you said.
That is what I said.
Or one shouldn't.
We should. I mean, you certainly could. Yeah. Plenty of people do. And I think also the inverse is true. Like, you should be careful about assessing yesterday's music by today's rules also. But you said something. You had said something similar, it turns out, in this Rock Critics interview that you had done in 2002 or whatnot. But it did get me thinking about being open and receptive and how so much of our taste profiles are really about where we were and what we were hearing in moments where we allowed ourselves to hear and where we allowed ourselves to feel. In that moment you just described outside your son's door, for whatever reason on that day, you were allowing some semblance of feeling, some framework.
That's right.
That either had not previously been available to you or was not available to you on the day that you had heard that record or
that's
whatnot.
Right.
That is the thing that I remain most excited. That's why I do this job, is I try to be open. I try to always be open to the possibility that I'll hear something in that way.
You've had the experience of hearing something, not liking it, hearing it again, not liking it, et cetera, and then one day you like it?
I don't want to overstate the case. Like, I'm reminded when you say it, when you frame it like that, I'm reminded of Chris Gow talking about the Backstreet Boys, I Want It That Way, which he was like, I heard on, you know how Bob is. I don't want to do a Bob impression.
Mm-hmm.
Bob is like, I heard that song 100 times and didn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
And then heard it being played by, I forget his daughter's name.
Oh.
And then I heard, it was a pop masterpiece. You
right.
know, like.
Right.
I don't want to say I've had anything that's such a literal transformation, but I do know that there are songs or artists who, when I first encountered them, I didn't either have the framework or allow myself to have the framework to fully take them in.
Yeah.
And then at some later point in life, it sneaks up on you.
Yeah.
It's there on VH1 Classic or Power 105 or, you know, Nash FM, whatever it is,
yeah,
they come at you.
Yeah.
And the opposite has happened. I've had very intense relationships with certain songs that you like walk away from mm-hmm. for whatever reason, and then 5 years later come back to you and you're like, what was I doing? Like, mm-hmm. what was going on with me where that spoke to me with such intensity?
You know, back to the issue of writing for the Times in particular, what's funny is that I feel that great things happen when all my circuits are on, mm-hmm. taking something in, and I'm ready for it. And as a friend of mine once said, like, my window is open, you know? Got mm-hmm. a little window
right it's real.
In my forehead uh-huh. here.
Your third eye.
Yeah.
And your third ear.
Yeah.
Is that a thing, third ear?
Yeah.
It is?
Yes.
Okay, great.
It's a book by Joachim Ernst Behrendt.
Shouts to him.
And so the window is open, and you're really hearing it, and you're very excited, and you're hearing it. You're hearing the best essence of this thing in a way. Mm. But then you have to write about it with that kind of New York Times moderation.
Universal yeah. Mm-hmm.
That can be difficult.
It can be, although I will say after a bunch of years here, I don't know, maybe it just comes more naturally. Maybe it's that my third ear and my other 2 ears are all, you know, pumping at the same speed.
Yeah.
I also think like, and this is a testament for me at least to reading you, is I feel very alive to the specific moments in a song or in an album in a way that I probably didn't 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I think I was writing maybe more historical criticism mm-hmm. where I was just contextualizing and saying, well, this matters because it's a reaction to this and it's a response to this mm-hmm. and it's an evolution of this or an innovation.
Yep.
Now I feel like I often choose to be animated by specific moments. And as a result, I'm now seeking language that obviously works in the context of what we do, but seeking language to nail that thing. And I'm trying to find, like, I'm always on a quest for words.
Yeah.
Like, that is the thing.
Yeah.
The feeling's not hard, but I feel like forever on a quest for the word that's going to communicate it correctly, get through the copy desk, not even if it's weird, get through the copy desk, you know, so that whatever copy editor or whatever editor, backfielder, and whatever reader will understand when I say something is milky mm-hmm. or whatnot, mm-hmm. that will resonate yes. and it will make sense.
Yep. My immediate predecessor, Peter Watrous, had words like that. Lemony. Mm. Lemony was a word he liked to use.
Love it. I get it.
Yeah, which kind of gets into the, like, food writing thing a little bit, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. I mean, it's no different. And also, I mean, you know, the sort of sidebar of like all criticism is kind of autobiography in a sense. It's like, to me, it is.
No, I believe that.
Yeah.
I believe that. Whether you want it to be or not.
Yeah. Oh, know? Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm not saying it's even intentional. I think it took me a long time before I realized that what I was doing was sort of a form of coded autobiography.
Sure. Yeah, so at a certain point, you stop worrying about it. You drop your anxiety about it. You're like, yeah, this is autobiography.
Well, I think it took a while to get it, and then once I got it, then it took a while to drop the anxiety. And now I'm just at peace with.
Although you do not use the first person very much.
I try very hard not to.
You are very principled about that.
It's important to me.
And I understand why. And I did that for a long time too, until I gave myself a break. I was like, I'll just do it. I mean, I worried actually about it being grandiose. I mean, I don't like reading critics who act like they're very important people.
Yeah, I mean, I think you managed to do it in a very non-grandiose way. I mean, I think it does run the risk. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people I've read who do it in exactly the opposite way. But mm-hmm. I think you do it in a way, you do it as a modest thing. I feel like you do it almost as like an offering. Like, I heard this thing. Mm-hmm. I felt this thing. Mm-hmm. I'm just here to bring it to you.
Yeah.
And that's a very different thing of like, I told you.
Yeah. Right, sure.
Which I think if I did first person, it'd probably sound more like that, being honest. Okay, so I was going to do like a mini speed Proust questionnaire, but I'll spare you. Because it's all about traits you deplore and whatnot.
Traits I deplore most in others?
Yeah. I mean, you can tell me the answer if you want.
Avarice.
Yeah.
Calumny. Fecklessness.
And the other Carter sisters. Yeah. Any last words?
Yeah, there are some last words. I want to say that working with you in this forum has been incredibly fun. We always come in here with an idea that's like, you know, this size, kind of small. And then just through talking, being silly, just throwing things around, it becomes bigger. And the ideas start edging into larger concerns, ongoing concerns that we have. And it just becomes a good, every time becomes a good conversation.
Yeah.
And I want to tell everybody listening, if they don't know already, that they're in good hands with you.
If they like the sound art that is male tears, they are going to agree with you. I guess the last thing that I want to ask is, tell me the best parts of working with me. I'm just playing. It's a tremendously sad thing that you're leaving. You've taught me a lot. I want to go out on a song that I don't know if you'll know why I'm going out on it, but I'll tell you as we're going out on it.
Yeah.
And that is Daniel Bedingfield's Gotta Get Through This.
I know why.
You know why. As we're outroing, you know why I'm playing the song.
I do.
Tell me.
That was the first time I met you,
John. It was SOBs, maybe 2000. We're outside with SFJ after the show. Very, very uninspiring show.
Yeah.
And we talked about this song, which was Bedingfield's hit at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about other things too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were back from England.
Yeah.
And you were sort of like bursting with ambition. You were ready to write. To write all over the damn place.
Damn right.
You were asking me about jazz music, man. Do you remember that?
No.
Yes, you were.
Wow, I
yes,
must have been
you
really
were. You were like, I want to write. You wanted to write something. John Scofield or something.
Christ. Yeah. How strange.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we all have our weak moments. This has been the New York Times Podcast. Ben Ratliff, thank you for everything.
Oh, John, thank you.
You know, Stitcher, iTunes, yada yada. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, our steady rock. That's a wrap. I'll see you guys next week.